Hey, this is John at Bible Project, and on today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Tim Mackey and Dr. Carissa Quinn, and we're going to look at Proverbs 8. The first nine chapters of the book of Proverbs contain nine speeches, and in these speeches, we meet four characters.
There are these contrasting pairs of couples, male and female. It's like a choose-your-own-adventure from the Eden story. Dear reader, who's called my son, you could listen to Adam and Eve, the redeemed version, who are the royal father and lady wisdom, and that leads to life. Or you can listen to the corrupted Adam and Eve, the wicked man and lady folly, and that leads to death. And it just for you, the reader, then it's like you are back in the garden, sitting in front of the trees, and you have these voices who are vying for your attention. And that's the drama of these poems.
These four characters are the foolish woman, contrasted with lady wisdom, the wicked man contrasted with the royal king. And in today's episode, we're going to look at a speech by Lady Wisdom, known as Proverbs chapter 8. We learn about who she is, what she values, and where she came from.
So there's four moments. Yahweh brought me forth. This is in verse 22. Then verse 23, I was formed. Verse 24 and 25 both use the same word. I was birthed. It's the word I underwent. I was the product of labor pains. It's the verb for to experience labor pains, giving birth. So she emerges from God's own being. She is an expression of God's own self going out into the world precisely when God is carving the cosmos.
It's actually this particular passage that held the interest of many in the early church who were trying to figure out who Jesus was.
In fact, it's precisely this paragraph that was one among a number of key biblical texts that was being debated at the Council of Nicaea when Athanasius and Arius were having this debate on, was Jesus the first of all of God's created beings, or is Jesus an eternal divine being who's a part of God's own identity? And Arius appealed to this very paragraph to say that the pre-incarnate Messiah was the first of God's creations because he's God's divine wisdom. So this is a charged question in many ways.
That's all ahead on today's episode. Thanks for joining us. Here we go. Hello, friends. We get to talk about the Bible as usual. And with us today is Tim Mackey. Hi, Tim. How are you doing?
Hey, John. I'm great.
And Carissa Quinn. Hi, Carissa.
Hey.
And we're working on this series, which is part of this larger, what we're calling the visual commentary series. And we've been working through different parts of the Bible that are connected to the theme of creation. So we did Genesis 1, we did Psalm 8, and now we are looking at Proverbs 8, which is a really cool reflection on creation from the perspective of Lady Wisdom. And so Tim's going to walk us through your notes, right?
Yep, I'm going to play tour guide through Proverbs 8. I don't know, may or may not be familiar. You know, when I was a new follower of Jesus, all I knew about Proverbs were like the little two-line sayings.
Yeah, for sure. Those catchy sayings.
And then, you know, maybe after I read it a time or two, you knew it began with the speeches of the Father that are like, you know, these calls to be wise and learn wisdom and don't be stupid and that kind of stuff. So I guess it probably really wasn't until I had started taking a class on biblical literature or on Old Testament theology, the prominence of this figure of Lady Wisdom really became clear to me. But she's a major character in the opening chapters of Proverbs. Actually, the poems connected to Lady Wisdom, and Proverbs 8 is the kind of climactic speech of this figure in the opening chapters of Proverbs. And this chapter is saturated in both creation language and hyperlinks back to Genesis 1, but also to all kinds of other things that are fascinating. And this chapter was a major resource for the apostles, too, when they were trying to use scriptural language and categories to talk about who Jesus was as both human and like more than human, but actually like the God of Israel come among them. And so Proverbs 8 ends up having this huge influence in the Gospel of John, in the letter to the Hebrews, in Paul's letters. So it pays off to put in some time with Proverbs 8. Kind of the whole Bible starts to unlock in pretty cool ways.
Yeah, it's so cool that there's this very prominent woman here speaking. And this is a really long speech. It's not just a short part. It's long, and she's kind of feels like a mystical woman. I love how our artists, when they worked on this video, created the universe in her flowing hair. It's so appropriate because it's like she's woven into the very fabric of creation. She's like this beautiful, mystical, wise lady. Just a very cool figure.
Yeah, she's an epic figure. And you're right. She kind of takes the stage alongside a number of other prominent female characters. I think she probably takes the cake in terms of the most cosmic. And, you know, she's, as we're going to see, she's a literary personification of God's own cosmic wisdom. So in that sense, Lady Wisdom is in a category all her own in the Hebrew Bible. There's nothing else quite like her, save the portrait of God himself, him or herself. I mean, this is where our language starts to break the categories, right?
When we did the God series, and we started talking about these characters who really merge this idea between, is this Yahweh or is this another character? She was one that we looked at. But alongside her were the angel of the Lord. It seems like there's a little bit of, like, a category of
the word.
Speech of God.
Yeah, the speech of God, the wisdom of God, the spirit, and then also the angel or the messenger of Yahweh. Main ones we looked at.
I remember when you guys were talking about how the word and the wisdom and the characteristics of God are both distinct from God. They're not God himself, but they're inherently united with his person.
Yeah, the Hebrew Bible has actually a sophisticated way of talking about the nature and being of the one God, the story the Bible is all about. And these attributes of God, they don't summarize the totality of the divine essence in all of its, you know, infinite variety, but it is genuinely a manifestation, a character trait of the divine. And so we kind of lack categories for it. But these personified attributes of God, they are divine. And yet humans can experience them as their own entity, distinct from, but also one with God. And it's hard for me as a follower of Jesus not to use the language given to me eventually by the apostles and then the Nicene Creed and Trinitarian categories, because that's where it all went. But the seedbed of this language was right here in the book of Proverbs. So actually, we're already getting to like the deep end of the pool by the time you get to the end of Proverbs 8. So let's first just kind of back up. Let's spend a few minutes. I'd like to just make some observations about actually just the macro literary design of Proverbs that has some illuminating things for us to see about this character of Lady Wisdom. Set the book of Proverbs in the Hebrew Bible, how that all fits together. But you guys are going to have to force me not to take like a whole half hour to do just that. But I think it's just helpful for thinking about who Lady Wisdom is and why she sits alongside the voice of a royal father and those two voices that dominate the landscape of the early part of Proverbs. We'll get some macro setting, then we'll dive in and read Proverbs 8 together. Does that sound good to you guys?
Sounds yes. Great.
Sweet. When we think about the whole book of Proverbs, different scholars have tried to discern the organizational structures at work in the book as a whole. It's actually fairly debated, mostly because the literary structure of the book as a whole really depends on what you're looking for or what you think is most prominent. So I'm most persuaded that the mention of Solomon in the book is kind of the key macro structural feature. And when you look at the mention of Solomon, you find his name appears at three prominent points that I think are the organizational kind of hinges for the three big blocks of it. So that's the speeches of chapters 1 through 9. It's all these long speeches. There aren't any little two-line, little clever proverbs in the first chunk, which is chapters 1 through 9. And that chunk begins, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel. The next big chunk starts in chapter 10, and it repeats the heading again. It says, the Proverbs of Solomon.
And you don't get that header anywhere else before 10, the Proverbs of Solomon.
No, uh-uh. So in other words, the book opens with a line, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. And then what you get aren't really proverbs. What you get are speeches, long poetic speeches that explain what the book as a whole is for and kind of set it within the Hebrew Bible. Then in chapter 10, you get this little reboot. Okay, now the Proverbs of Solomon. And then you get the hundreds and hundreds of the little two-line proverbs.
And so you could argue then that this is just the main division. And then the rest of the book, 10 through 31, is just one big block of proverbs.
Except you get to chapter 25. Verse 1, and you get another one of these little headings that it says, these are more Proverbs of Solomon that the men of Hezekiah, the king of Judah, collected. So Hezekiah is a couple centuries after Solomon, still the same royal line of David. So Hezekiah is like great, 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 great grandson of Solomon and David. And we're told that in Hezekiah's day, there was another recollection or a new collection made of Proverbs of Solomon, and that begins the third main section of the book. What's fascinating is that more Proverbs of Solomon go through 25 through 29, and then at the end of the book, chapter 30 and chapter 31 are collections of proverbs and speeches from two other people that are not Solomon, explicitly says it. So chapter 30 is called the Words of Agur. Nobody knows who he is, but it's a great name.
It's an intense name.
And then chapter 31 is the words of King Lemuel, the wisdom that his mother taught him. And that's the last chapter. So you have these three big blocks. And in the third block, you get Proverbs of Solomon and then the wisdom of two other figures.
It's almost like the wisdom of Solomon is being carried on by later people.
Yeah, or you could say that what's going on in these two, the words of Agur and the words of King Lemuel, both of them are testaments of wisdom that seems to stand outside of the line of Israel's kings. Because Agur is a king, but he's not an Israelite king that's ever mentioned anywhere in the Old Testament. It kind of affirms something that we're going to see Lady Wisdom says all the way back, and what we're going to see is anywhere you see a king or a ruler being wise, living wisely and leading with wisdom and justice, they are, even if they don't know it, living by divine wisdom. And so it's as if that thing that Lady Wisdom said back in chapter 8 gets a whole demonstration in the final chapter of the book. Final chapter of the book also has the epic poem about the wise woman, the Proverbs 31 woman, which I know has a whole history attached to it, depending on what Christian tradition you're part of. But that wise woman is an embodiment of all the vocabulary and ideas of Lady Wisdom throughout the speeches in chapters 1 through 9. So it's as if Lady Wisdom is both a bookend for the speeches at the beginning and the speeches that end the book. So there's a lot more to do here, but it's just to say the whole book actually has a really cohesive organization. And you can kind of see the main themes emerging here. We have men and women who are living by the wisdom of God. They become these like supercharged, superhuman versions of themselves because they're tapping into God's own divine wisdom, which has both male and female aspects to it, with Solomon and Lady Wisdom in the first big block, and then Lemuel and the wise woman that he sings about in his poem. So I've just always thought this is so cool. It just has a different set of emphases and a different way of talking about it than anywhere else in the Hebrew Bible. It's super cool.
Yeah, do you think that the attributes from Lady Wisdom and from the father passing on wisdom to the son, do you think that the father and Lady Wisdom are meant to represent a masculine and feminine depiction of God in the book, or masculine and feminine wisdom? Do you think that's part of the role of having those two characters?
Yes, but also even more specific. So John, this was the How to Read Wisdom Literature conversations that we had in the How to Read the Bible series. Mm-hmm. And for me, my last like deep dive into the books of Solomon, which is Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Songs.
Which we left out.
No, we included that in the video for How to Read the Books of Solomon.
Oh, the How to Read.
Yeah. We actually ended up not calling at how to read wisdom literature, we just called it How to Read the Books of Solomon, because I had a big paradigm shift about the function of these books in the Hebrew Bible. Solomon is an Adam figure. If you look at the portrait of him, he's another one of these new humans who steps up to the plate to live by God's wisdom and bring the blessing of God to others. And he fails precisely because of his own folly and greed for power, and then by listening to the voice of his non-Israelite wives who seduce him into idolatry. And so right there, Solomon and his wives, they're an image of the Adam and Eve story, of the fall narrative in the garden, but with the volume up to 11. So you have the greedy, power-hungry man, and you have this portrait in Kings of Solomon's seductive queen-like wives. And together, they become this portrait of corrupted wisdom that leads to slavery and death and ultimately exile. And so I think Proverbs is picking up on these archetypes.
Yeah, because we haven't said this yet, but in those 9 speeches at the beginning of Proverbs, there's 4 main characters.
There's 4 characters, that's right.
So Lady Wisdom is one, but out of the 9 speeches, 4 main characters, and one is the king that Krissa was referencing, and he's paired with Lady Wisdom. They both
speak God's wisdom, yeah.
But then there's 2 counterpart characters.
Yeah, that's right. It's like the royal father and Lady Wisdom are both mouthpieces for God's invitation to live by his wisdom. And Lady Wisdom is called, in Proverbs 3, a tree of life. And the royal father is offering wisdom that leads to length of days, eternal life. But they have these, what do you call them? Are they doppelgangers? Were they like, they're counterparts?
Antagonists, yeah, counterparts.
What's like, when you have like a story where it's clear characters, foils?
The foil, yeah.
Yeah, the foil.
Do we use that word still?
But they're mirror opposites of each other. So the opposite, in the first speech of the father in chapter 1 of Proverbs, he starts talking about somebody who's just called the wicked man or the violent man. And he's everything opposite of what the father is telling you. And there's a speech that the wicked man makes, and he's like, come, my son, let's plunder the helpless. Let's get rich and rob the poor and strip them of their clothes, and we'll get plunder and booty and so on. It sounds like Solomon on the bad narratives, you know, about him. And then you also meet a female opposite to Lady Wisdom, who's called by a variety of names, Lady Folly, or the Strange Woman, Lady Strange. And she's constantly inviting the reader and the son to all of this, just like sensuality and illicit sex and adultery and illegitimate ways to get rich, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there are these contrasting pairs of couples, male and female, each. Each of them are all, I think, it's like a choose-your-own-adventure from the Eden story. Mm-hmm. Dear reader, who's called my son, you could listen to Adam and Eve, the redeemed version, who are the royal father and Lady Wisdom, and that leads to life. Or you can listen to the corrupted Adam and Eve, the wicked man and Lady Folly, and that leads to death. And it just for you, the reader, then it's like you are back in the garden sitting in front of the trees, and you have these voices who are vying for your attention. And that's the drama of these poems in the opening of Proverbs.
So I think Chris is putting her finger on it in that you've got the father and Lady Wisdom, which are like a redeemed Adam and Eve, which are the image of God. And it's how God's wisdom is meant to be manifest in the world. And so in a way, yes, you've got this picture of what is God manifest in the world, both male and female, as the image. And this is a cool depiction of that.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool that in the very beginning, in the prologue, the audience is called, I mean, you've said this a couple times, but the audience is called the son or the child, and also young ones or youth.
Yeah.
So it's almost this liminal setting in life, maybe symbolically, because other places the audience is just called all people or all humans or the open, the simple. So it's like all people are set in this setting of choice where they're discovering what's wise and what's foolish. And the book is depicting these two ways, and the wise father saying, hey, choose what's good, really what brings the most joy for you, which is Lady Wisdom. Sheree Hayes on our education team right now is writing a blog about how Lady Wisdom's way doesn't take away joy, it brings ultimate joy. And that's what the father's trying to help the sun see, which is all of us.
Yeah, we could just spend this whole conversation talking about this macro stuff. The character of my son, who's you, the reader, are in that position, is called, like you said, the sun, the young one. But also, our translations go different ways in rendering this word. It's the Hebrew word peti, which is the simple-minded one. But it means the one who hasn't learned anything yet.
Yeah, it's related to the word open, patah. So like the one who's open to everything but committed to nothing.
Yes. It just hit me one day like, oh, this is Proverbs' way of conceiving of Adam and Eve before the snake, the simple ones. They haven't learned good and evil yet.
Yeah, that adolescent stage of Adam and Eve. How are they going to gain their wisdom?
That's right.
How are you going to gain your wisdom?
The assumed backdrop through design patterns and all these hyperlinks. For all the sons of Adam and Eve, you have your own garden test to undergo as you live your life. And which set of voices will you listen to? The ones that image God's wisdom. And God's image is male and female on page one. And so, of course, God's wisdom will have both a male and female portrayal in the book of Proverbs. It just makes sense that it would. It couldn't be otherwise, really, if you think about it. And I just never thought about it this way, except the last couple of years learning how design patterns work in the Hebrew Bible. And all of a sudden, Lady Wisdom isn't just a solo act. She's actually paired with the royal king. And together, you can learn divine wisdom from them both. Let's zoom in to Proverbs 1 through 9, because that's the setting for Lady Wisdom's speech in Proverbs 1 through 8. So essentially, the royal father and Lady Wisdom, they're going to be speaking throughout the opening speeches. And the speeches in chapters 1 through 9 are, lo and behold, themselves organized in a group of three. And then within each of those big three sections, there's also threes within threes and so on. It's really remarkable and also predictable, I think, for how biblical literature works. So there's three big speeches of Lady Wisdom, once in each of these groups. The first one's in chapter one, and she's standing at the gates of a city by the crossroads saying, "Everybody, come to me." And it's a warning. She's saying, "Listen, man, the wicked man's going to eat your lunch." Like, you're going to die, you're going to be brought to poverty, and just don't be stupid, listen to me. That's her first speech.
And by the way, the city, that's all connected to the Eden idea too. On a mountain, it's Jerusalem, which is the Eden become a city.
You got it. If you listen to Lady Wisdom, you'll find your way back to Eden. Hmm. In chapter 3, the father gives a speech about Lady Wisdom, and he calls her a tree of life.
Yeah.
That if you listen to wisdom, you'll grab onto the tree of life and have length of days. And it's really like you'll have healthy bones. Your bones will like grow fresh and new.
That's awesome. I want that.
Totally. I want that too. I especially want that right now in middle age. So this portrait is emerging of like, man, Lady Wisdom. You got to get some Lady Wisdom in your life. And so the whole of the speeches build up to these competing voices of Lady Folly and Lady Wisdom. Chapter 7 is this culminating speech of Lady Folly. And she wants to get you into bed with her, and she's going to ruin your life and take you to the grave, actually. And then matching and contrasting Lady Folly's speech in chapter 7 comes Lady Wisdom's speech in chapter 8. So there's even the narrative drama, even though it's not a narrative in literary form, there's a drama of the voices competing. And it all comes down to chapter 7, Lady Folly, chapter 8, Lady Wisdom, and then in chapter 9, there's a portrait of Lady Wisdom builds a house on a hill with seven pillars. And she invites you to come to her table. And then you hear Lady Folly has a house with a feast and she's inviting you to come. What are you going to choose? And then the curtain closes and you move on to chapter 10 and all the little two-line proverbs begin. So if you know how to discern that dramatic plot design, Proverbs 8 is the last major appeal of Lady Wisdom. That's the basic point. It's sort of like it's her final appeal. Imagine like a courtroom scene.
Yeah, closing arguments.
Yeah, that's it.
It's really compelling too, especially in contrast with Lady Folly, who does things in secret and her pleasures are temporary. Yeah, the way of Lady Wisdom. When I read it, I found it to be super refreshing. The transparency, the words being always true and dependable.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, she's a straight shooter. She doesn't mince her words, and she speaks with authority.
And she calls out to everyone. She invites everyone in public.
Okay, so that's the setting. Is that a fairly clear portrait? I think I'm being clear and trying to take us through it, but maybe there's something that is not clear, or should we dive into Proverbs 8?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, I'd say let's just kind of read our way. I'm starting on page 13 of the notes, and maybe, I don't know, I'll let you guys read back and forth different sections, and we'll just kind of see what's interesting.
Why don't I read the first part and then Carissa can be Lady Wisdom after that.
Oh, that's true. Actually, okay. The first part is the royal father kind of setting Lady Wisdom on the stage, verses 1-3.
Doesn't wisdom cry out and understanding raise her voice? At the head of high places, by the road, at the junction of roads, she stands. By the side of gates, at the entrance of the city, at the entrance of the doors, she shouts. This part is, like we talked about, she's at that junction point. This is the test. Are you going to listen to her and go into the city or not? It's a really beautiful image.
Yeah, it's like this crossroads where decisions are made. You said this earlier, I think, John, right? That decisions are made at the gates of the city? Or did we talk about that?
We didn't.
Oh, okay. That, like in the Book of Ruth, you know, all the elders gather and they make mm-hmm. decisions there. So she's up there helping people decide.
Yeah, the point is she's like a player among the leading voices of the city at the gates. And the gates is where everybody goes in and out.
She's the port authority.
Yeah, totally. City centers or city squares or plazas used to function this way. In every city, it's different now, of course, but that's the idea. The assumption is there's a central place where everybody gathers, the leaders gather, and she's there, giving her speech, and her speech begins. The first movement is verses 4-11.
This is what she says. To you, men, and that could be just, oh, people or something, right?
So this is worth naming, the assumed in the narrative of the four voices, the good ones and the bad ones, and who they're addressing is a figure called the Son. It's as if Solomon is speaking to the line of David. So that's interesting because it is in terms of the gender dynamics at work, because the seed of David and the sonship of David is going to come to include males and females of Israel and the remnant and all nations. But I don't know, Carissa, when you encounter this male gender dynamic that the audience is assumed male, I guess for every person it's probably different.
Yeah.
How do you experience that?
Well, yeah, I'm thinking about that now. So in context of this story, the characters are male and female, especially with Lady Folly and the young son being drawn into a woman's house. Those are characters that are male and female there. So I think, yeah, as I read, I probably picture the story with those male and female characters, but then there are truths that I would draw from that story for myself.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe just changing the word to people then doesn't do justice to the characters in the story, if that makes sense. Still, it is addressed in a sense to all humans, but it's being cast in the characters of this woman and sons or men. Sons of human, in the next line, though, is a more inclusive term. All humanity, sons of human.
Sons of Adam, sons of humanity.
Okay, so here's what she says.
We made it through one half of a verse.
Okay. To you, men, I cry out, and my voice is to the sons of human. Gullible ones, that's that word for open ones or simple, understand shrewdness, and fools understand in your heart. Listen, for I speak things that are right, and I open my mouth for upright things. For my mouth whispers truth, and wickedness is detestable to my lips. All the words of my mouth are with righteousness. There is nothing twisted or crooked. All of them are right to the understanding one, and upright to those who find knowledge. Take my instruction and not silver, and knowledge more than choice, pure gold. For wisdom is good, more than pearls, and nothing desirable can compare with her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting how much speech is emphasized here.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
There's so many lines about her speech being right, upright, true, not wicked, not twisted or crooked.
I know I start to sound like a broken record about how all roads lead back to Genesis 1-3, but the focus of that narrative is about a dialogue between a man and a woman, and then this deceiver, the snake, and the whole debate is about who's telling the truth about the word of God. whose words are upright and whose words are crooked. And that's exactly the way she presents the drama.
Mm.
So she's like saying, listen, I'm not the crooked one. You've been hearing a crooked voice throughout these chapters, and it's not my voice. And look at the emphasis. My words are right and upright and true and righteous. And that's who the gullible ones. If you don't know the difference between right and wrong yet, I'm the place that you want to find wisdom. I think that emphasis on speech actually has its roots all the way back in the debate about the wise words of God in Genesis 3.
Tim, is this your translation?
It is, yeah.
What's the distinction between wisdom and understanding? These words, are they just pure synonyms, or is there some sort of distinction we should be thinking about?
Yeah, they all have different nuances. Man, just as a reference for anybody who wants to follow the rabbit trail deeper, Michael V. Fox, the biblical scholar, he wrote, I think, one of the most thorough commentaries on the book of Proverbs in the modern era, published about 10-ish years ago each. So in his Anchor Bible commentary, and he has a whole commentary just on Proverbs 1 through 9, but he has about 20 pages about the wisdom vocabulary, all of it. It's like short little word studies that are a page or two each on all the wisdom words in the Bible. It's worth its weight in gold. So insightful. So wisdom, we did this in our Proverbs video. It's not primarily an intellectual or mental focused word, but it's about know-how, I think the English phrase that captures it best. It's practical, applied wisdom.
Practical, social, like a social skill of righteousness almost.
Yeah, so remember the designers and craftsmen of the tabernacle are called, they're filled with chokmah, wisdom. When Solomon employs all of these goldsmiths to do the carving of all the gold stuff, he calls all who are chokmah of heart, wise of heart, they're skilled. So it's the kind of knowledge that you see them demonstrate it through their actions. They know their medium and they know the craft, and you see their know-how on display by how they act. Whereas understanding is focusing in on a mindset. You are able to comprehend and understand what is the right thing to do or the best thing to do. And then chokmah, wisdom, is then you're actually making those choices to do it.
Yeah, it seems like in the book of Proverbs, it's not IQ or just knowledge, but it's this effective knowledge that is also really connected to committedness to Yahweh in your heart, like committedness and devotion to Yahweh. I'm even thinking of that relationship between the fear of Yahweh and wisdom. There's like a reciprocal relationship there. When you are devoted to Yahweh, you gain wisdom. When you gain wisdom, that helps you understand the fear of Yahweh or helps you know him more.
Yeah, and even that knowing is the other Hebrew word, the word knowledge or knowing, which is the relational, reciprocal knowing and being known. So we've got three words, wisdom in this paragraph, understanding, which is about discernment, what we might call discernment, and then knowledge is about this reciprocal relational knowing.
There's also instruction.
Yeah, there's stuff that you don't know that you need to know.
Let me explain it.
Oh man, my 9-year-old son is in this phase right now where anytime you try to help him see that he's doing something that is not the right way of doing it, you know, and it's not going to work out for him. And it's anything from Legos to art project to how he's making his toast or something. So I'll be like, oh, buddy, you know, like you need to turn the little like toaster oven on this way. Otherwise, you're going to burn your toast. And his response to me, I don't know where he got this. He'll just resist me and say, I know, I know. And I'll be like, well, buddy, I don't think you actually do know, because you turned like the toaster oven up to 10. You're going to fry your toast. And he's like, I know, Dad. I'm like, but I don't think you do know. And it just becomes a loop. And then I just have to stop and like walk away because he doesn't want to take instruction. Anyway.
Therein lies, I think, an insight to all of us.
But you're saying, just like humans, we don't want to think that we don't know something. It's hard for
them. It is really hard to learn something new. It makes you feel, there's that big fancy word, disequilibrated. And it's just scary sometimes to have a new piece of information. And so, yeah, it's tricky. I love these last two verses in this first part of the speech. She's comparing herself to riches, wealth. It makes sense, right? Because we all love wealth. But it seems like there's also a deeper design pattern here with how Solomon's relationship with gold.
Totally. Totally, John. Good call. Yeah, you're paying attention to the fact that Solomon, a major emphasis of his story is the narrator talking constantly about how much gold he acquires.
Yeah.
And the stuff he makes out of gold that's totally unnecessary, like all the gold shields and so on. So he ended up preferring gold to wisdom.
I like that the idea of desire is brought in here too. It's not just saying choose wisdom because it's the right way. It's actually nothing desirable. Nothing we desire, and wealth being one of those desirable things, can compare with her. Yeah, it's hard to believe that, but I think that's what the point of the poem is. If we don't believe that, we haven't fully met her or experienced her or her goodness.
Yeah, this is also Genesis 3 vocabulary, the language of desire. The forbidden tree was desirable for gaining wisdom. That's Genesis 3, verse 6.
Yeah, and then the very next verse, I can keep reading her speech, but it uses the word shrewd, just like the snake was shrewd, but now she's using this shrewdness in a positive way for wisdom, I guess.
To your point, it's about desire. In other words, to become wise in the fear of the Lord in the worldview of Proverbs isn't just that you're strategic and you know how to make successful life decisions, including ethical ones, but it's also about the shaping of desire, that what you desire is actually the things that are good according to God's wisdom and that lead to life for you and others. And sometimes the right thing to do is not what you desire. And how do I come to desire it so that I can want the right thing anyway?
Yeah, and that thing is actually ultimately more life-giving and desirable in the long run. Okay, yeah, I'll keep reading 12 through 16. Her speech continues.
Great.
I, wisdom, live with shrewdness, and I discovered knowledge of strategy. I like that translation. That's cool. The fear of Yahweh is hating evil, pride and arrogance and the evil path, and the twisted mouth I hate. To me belongs counsel and planning. I am understanding. To me belongs power. Through me, kings reign and rulers carve decrees that are just. Through me, princes rule, and nobles, all who judge with justice.
Mm-hmm. I like to think of this section as she's kind of like pulling out her CV. Or she's like pulling out, like, here's people who work with me. And it's a way of increasing her appeal.
Yeah, so her appeal so far was her speech is true, or she's true, and then she's valuable, greater than pearls and gold.
Well, when you see a king or a ruler, like, bringing order and justice to the land, yeah, they came and talked to me. They're actually using me.
Whether or not they're going to acknowledge it or even realize it, that was me.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, I mean, John, like when you're in the advertising world and you had your company's landing page and you're like, we've worked with Apple and Nike and Intel. And like, it's that. That's what she's saying.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the shrewdness thing. That's really interesting. The snake in the garden was the crafty, shrewd character. But she's like, I'm the shrewd character. There's the Jesus says, be innocent like doves. Shrewd like snakes. What is going on? I don't fully understand this idea of shrewdness and how it relates to wisdom.
Yeah, the word is not weighted with moral value. In other words, here's a divine figure, God, right? God's own wisdom exercises shrewdness. It comes from the Hebrew root aram, and so here it's orma. In Genesis 3, it's arum, but it's the same root word. Yeah, all kinds of figures can have orma or shrewdness. I think it's essentially that you know how to read a situation and know what's the advantageous thing to do that will lead to the outcome you desire.
In the strengths finder, that's called strategic.
Yeah, strategic.
Totally.
Which could be good or bad, right? Depending on your character.
Yeah. And actually, strategy is the word in the parallel poetic line. Shrewdness and strategy, which is the word mezimot, and it's the word for you know how to hatch a plan that will lead to the desired outcome.
Which actually Lady Folly or Lady Strange is also very strategic. It's interesting how both of these characters have these neutral ideas, like especially money, sex, and power, and they can be used for evil or they can be good and beautiful things. depending who's using them and what their character is.
It's kind of back to that motif that you mentioned a few minutes ago, Carissa, of shrewdness is a desirable skill to know how to size up a situation, make a plan that will work. The question is, toward what end? And it's that ultimate end that will determine if your shrewdness leads to life or leads to death. And she's like, if you want real shrewdness, don't go with Lady Folly.
Yeah.
You know, I've got the real stuff.
And it makes sense that this is setting up this whole idea of kings and princes ruling, because the amount of shrewdness you need to be able to lead a whole group of people wisely or well, the amount of planning and thinking and counsel, and yeah, it's intense.
Yeah, it's interesting that she's calling all humanity, especially the simple, and also is empowering rulers and kings.
That's a great observation. Are you kind of connecting their image of God from Genesis 1?
No, I was just thinking of the inclusiveness, but yeah, for sure that.
In other words, a statement where you invite the poor and the rich to use divine wisdom is a worldview in which every person is built with the potential to become royal priests who rule creation with God as an image.
Yeah, everyone has access to wisdom, which is actually exactly where she goes next.
Yes. Okay, so real quick here, just because there's an important little word that she uses for the first time here that's going to be key for later. When she talks about the kings reigning and rulers, I translated it carve decrees. Usually in most translations, it's who make decisions or issue decrees. The Hebrew word is chakak. It's a clearing your throat word on multiple fronts. Chakak. But it's the actual word to like carve or etch out. And it's the standard Hebrew word used to refer to decrees, or when leaders make a decision and then make it public, it's called often a chok or chukot. And it refers to the practice of like the Ten Commandments, carving. Yeah, carving a law or carving a decision into stone and then displaying it publicly. And so that carving is key, because Yahweh himself is going to be shown to use this carving skill to bring justice and order later on in the poem. But for right now, it's just important to kind of note that's the metaphor being used here, carving. Because when you carve a law, you're bringing order to a situation. Oh man, there's this corner by my house where it's a corner that coming all four directions, there's no stop sign from any direction. And every time I'd ride my bike through it or drive through it, I'm always freaked out because I've just seen it happen so many near accidents. It's chaos at my corner. And what we need to do is for someone to carve a decree to bring order to that corner.
We need some strategy and some uprightness.
Totally. So this carving metaphor is about bringing order out of chaos. And anyway, you can kind of see where this is going to be going into creation themes later on. So seriously, though, I need to like write a petition. Anyway, okay, should we keep rocking?
Okay, verses 17 through 21, she says, I love those who love me, and those who seek me will find me. Wealth and honor are with me, enduring abundance and righteousness. My fruit is good, more than pure gold, and my income more than gold, more than choice silver. I will walk in the path of righteousness, in the middle of the roads of justice, to give a substantial inheritance, and I will fill up their storehouses.
This section really matches that first part of this speech of gaining understanding and that it's better than gold and it will lead to abundance.
Yeah, it's a good example of how multiple paragraphs would like spiral and recover the same ground, but then take it a little further and develop it so that she's more valuable than gold and pure gold. That's literally copy and pasted from the earlier movement. But this idea that you can eat Lady Wisdom, she grows fruit that you can eat. For sure, that's an Eden image right there. She has righteousness and so on. She's amping it up now. She's not just saying wealth and honor are with me. She's saying you can have it. I'll give you the goods if you follow my wisdom.
And then seek and you will find. That's such an important idea.
Also an Eden image. The whole thing where they hide and the gods looking for them. And so it becomes this inversion of God looking for people and finding them, or people looking for God and finding or not finding him. I think it's all rooted in that little scene where God's looking for them and they hide and they come out. And anyway,
that verse is cool though. I love those who love me. Those who seek me will find me. There's some assurance there. It's not when you seek wisdom, there's assurance that you will find her, and that's pretty reassuring.
All right. So this leads up to the climax of her appeal, which is a long three-part paragraph in verses 22 to 31. So Carissa, do us the honors of reading it aloud.
Yahweh brought me forth at the beginning of his way, earlier than his acts of old. In the remote past, I was formed from the beginning, from the earliest times of the land. When there were no deep waters, I was birthed. When there were no springs heavy with water, before mountains were sunk deep, before the hills, I was birthed. Before he made the land and open fields and the first clumps of soil. When he established the skies, I was there. When he carved a horizon on the face of the deep waters, when he made firm the clouds above, when he strengthened the springs of the deep water, when he set a carved boundary for the sea, so the waters would not cross his command, when he inscribed the foundations of the land. I was growing up beside him. Or did you translate this differently later?
It's a very difficult word to interpret and translate.
For some reason, I thought you had, I was with him continually.
Yes. So we'll talk about it.
Okay. And I was daily an object of delight, celebrating before him the entire time, celebrating the inhabited world of the land, delighting in the sons of human.
So many rabbit holes here.
You know, right? There's a lot here.
You can just feel, on a very simple level, you can feel the Genesis 1 language and just the theme of creation that's just all packed in right here.
Yeah, there is so much. But what's her main idea here?
Well, think, if she appealed to the people she's worked with as, you know, establishing her credentials, kings and rulers use me, then this is one-upping that, where she's saying, I was brought into existence for God's own self to use me and work with me. And I was there before any king or ruler was carving just decrees. I was there with him when God was carving order out of chaos. So I think that's how it fits in terms of her persuasion.
Which makes this match that second part of the speech. So at a macro level, we've got the first and third part of the speech matching and the second and the fourth part of the speech matching.
It's a nice little symmetry. So, I mean, man, what do you guys want to talk about? There's so many cool things. The birth imagery is pretty prominent. She's talking about how Yahweh gave birth to her. Brought her forth.
Well, yeah, what's the deal?
Carissa, have you started working on the birth imagery yet?
Yeah, I did. I was writing a reflection.
For the Reflections podcast.
On metaphors. And so I was looking at the birth metaphor, but what I found was that birthing, childbirth, and then God being compared to a birthing mother had a lot to do with both suffering and crisis, but also transformation and bringing new life, like that new creative life.
For bigger context, what you're saying is you've been doing a study on all the places where God's depicted as a mother giving birth. You're noticing these kind of themes in the different places that metaphor appears.
Yeah, that birthing involves suffering. I mean, it's a difficult act. So there's labor involved. So God labors for people and for creation, but it brings forth new creation, which I think is probably the imagery being used here. The birthing imagery is like compared with creating. I mean, birthing and creating, we even use those things similarly today. It's transformative, but I don't know. So now here, if God is birthing wisdom.
So many things going on here. So there's four moments. Yahweh brought me forth. This is in verse 22. Then verse 23, I was formed. Verse 24 and 25 both use the same word. I was birthed. It's the word I underwent. I was the product of labor pains. It's the verb for to experience labor pains, giving birth. So she emerges from God's own being. She is in a expression of God's own self going out into the world precisely when God is carving. It's that same word, carving the cosmos. And notice the three-tiered cosmos here from Genesis 1. So you have the deep waters and God carves a line in verse 27 to separate the skies from the waters below. That's day two, separating the waters. And then in verse 29, he carves a line for the sea so that the dry land can be separated from the waters below, which is day three. So it's a poetic commentary on days two and three of Genesis, which is cool.
Using the carving vocabulary.
Just what the kings were doing is what God was doing for the whole cosmos. Carving order of chaos. Okay, so think with me here. In Genesis 1, when is there something emerging out of God's own being to go out into the void and participate in the ordering and the carving up of chaos?
Yeah, it's his word and his spirit.
So in other words, there's no way this is unconnected. This is the author of Proverbs' way of reflecting on the Word and the Spirit, but in the slot of Word and Spirit in Genesis 1 comes God's wisdom. Yeah, there are different ways of imagining the same thing. It's God's wisdom, so it's divine, but yet it's the aspect of God that he used to create something other than God's own self. So it's both distinct from God and divine at the same time, which then, look at verse 30 and 31, I think makes sense of the metaphor shift. Actually, they continue from the birthing imagery. Now that God has birthed wisdom, verse 30 and 31, wisdom describes herself as a little girl.
Growing up beside him, an object of delight, celebrating the inhabited world and delighting in humans.
So both the language of delight is used a number of times. It's associated with children, the play and the laughter of children, if you do a word search on it.
This is the word laughing, right?
Yeah, it's one of them.
Real quick, the birthing metaphor then, just to follow up on that for myself. So do you think the birthing metaphor is about that unity and distinction? So it's like from the metaphor is like it's from the same body, from God's very own self, but also as a distinct person. Is that the function it's playing?
I think so. Yes. In fact, I'll use the words of Bruce Waltke. He does a better job. This is in the middle of page 16. Commenting on this, he says, "The Lord is depicted as procreator who also brought forth wisdom. The metaphor brought me forth signifies that, in the narrative of the book, Solomon's inspired wisdom, right? It's the father's wisdom and then lady wisdom, but it comes from God's own essential being. So Solomon is depending himself on God's wisdom, which is depicted as the lady wisdom. So Waltke goes on, it's a revelation that has an organic connection to God's very nature and being, unlike the rest of creation that came into existence outside of God and independent of his being. So it's just saying in biblical thought, you have God, and then you have what is not God, that is creation. And what's the relationship between the two? And it's wisdom. Wisdom is what emerges from God, birth, and then orders and brings forth what is not God. And so here I am, a little creature that's not God, but I'm given this personal connection to the very being of God that is through wisdom. And he's saying that it's a way of talking about something that is both distinct from God and also God. Again, this chapter is the seedbed of the categories that will give birth to Trinitarian thought after the time of Jesus. Certainly, this isn't all the birth imagery is doing, but for sure it's one big part of it.
So then, help me understand the growing up imagery, because to me, it feels a little strange that if God's wisdom, his essence, is birthed forth as wisdom, I would just imagine it being fully matured, right? Like, what does it mean that wisdom's growing up?
Okay, so this is an age-old question that Christians have had when they read Proverbs 8. In fact, it's precisely this paragraph that was one among a number of key biblical texts that was being debated at the Council of Nicaea when Athanasius and Arius were having this debate on, was Jesus the first of all of God's created beings, or is Jesus an eternal divine being who's a part of God's own identity? And Arius appealed to this very paragraph to say that the pre-incarnate Messiah was the first of God's creations, because he's God's divine wisdom. So this is a charged question in many ways. So the Hebrew word, it gets translated in different ways. Verse 30, sometimes it's translated, I was a craftsman beside him or with him, or an artisan. The Hebrew word is amon. And it's not a common word. It's maybe used in one other place. But it's all about what root does it come from, and people debate these things. So New American Standard, ESV, translates it as master workman. So it's depicting wisdom as like the tool or the contractor that God uses to make the cosmos. The word also appears a couple times, or a different form of the word appears, to describe someone, a nursling or a young child, who is being brought up or raised up by someone. And that's what the King James chose way back when. And so it translates, "Then I was by him as one brought up with him." There's another view that thinks it's related to the root that you did a word study video on, Krissa, the amen root, yeah. In which case it would mean
continually or faithfully. Yeah.
Continually, which is what the NIV has gone with. "Then I was constantly by his side." So my current view, which keeps developing every time I come back to this problem, is that I think it's probably a double meaning between the faithfully, constantly, and the child image, because the birth imagery is so strong in the context of God bringing forth one. But the one that he's bringing forth isn't something that God creates. Wisdom is essential to God's own very being. So the birth imagery, I think, is metaphorical because it's about the birthing of creation. And so creation emerges from God as he carves and creates. But the idea of a being who is distinct from but unified with, the key image in the Hebrew Bible for that is the parent and the child, the father and the son, the mother and the daughter. And the apostles are going to capitalize on both of these meanings. Like John, maybe that's where we could land the plane on this conversation, by thinking about how John chapter 1, it seems to be aware of what's going on here in Proverbs 8.
I think that would be good. And we don't have a lot of time. But yeah, John 1, he explicitly introduces Jesus as the Word of God from the beginning. Doesn't ever use the wisdom of God vocabulary, does he?
No, what's great is he uses the language and categories of Proverbs 8, but instead of using the word wisdom, he uses the word word. So it shows in his mind, Proverbs 8 and Genesis 1 are self-interpreting. You need to ponder them both together.
Yeah. Like you said, that wisdom is in the slot of the word in Genesis 1.
So in John 1, when he says, "In the beginning is the word," it's both from Genesis 1, but also that's what Lady Wisdom said. "I was in the beginning with him,"
yeah,
beside him. And so when John says, "All things came into being through him, apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being," it's a meditation on both chapters, Proverbs 8 and Genesis 1. An eternal child of God that is both divine and distinct from the divine, that is with God and was God. It's hard to think of a better short summary of Proverbs 8, portrait of wisdom, isn't it?
You know what's fascinating is in the Gospels, there is this real absence of Jesus growing up, except for that one little story in Luke. So as we talk about this idea of growing up beside him, I just thought of that story of Jesus sitting at the temple.
He grew in wisdom, it says.
And speaking about his father, "Didn't you know I had to be in the house of my father?" So I think what we're not saying, what Proverbs 8 is not saying, there was a time in the pre-creation state when God didn't have wisdom, and then he created wisdom. That's not what the metaphors are saying. These are metaphorical ways of trying to say something that we don't have categories for, which is wisdom is so a part of God's essence and nature, but it's only one part. It's not the whole part. God is also all kinds of other things too. But that wisdom is a part through which God has reached out to create and interact with what is not God, that is his creatures. God wants his own creatures to participate in that wisdom and share in that divine wisdom. And so it goes out from God. What are metaphors that can do that? Birthing, children, speaking. And these are metaphors to describe the relationship of God and God's wisdom. And it makes all the sense in the world why John, for example, would use these categories to talk about and express his own conviction of Jesus as the eternal son, who was not created, but who was with God and was God.
Yeah, because another thing we're not saying is that Jesus is merely the incarnation of Lady Wisdom or the incarnation of God's speech in Genesis 1. It's like using those metaphors, but then Jesus is, how does Paul say it? The exact representation of his being.
The emanation of his glory and the imprint of his nature.
Oh yeah, that is Paul in Ephesians. So that is a whole nother conversation.
But isn't it cool how Proverbs 8 takes us there? She gives one final paragraph. It's verses 32 to 36. She says, "So now, sons, I've made my case. Listen to me. How fortunate are those who keep my ways, listen to instruction, become wise, don't ignore me. How fortunate are the humans who listen, who watch by my doors daily, who stand at the door of the entrance. Notice she's back at the city talking about the doors. The one who finds me finds life, finds favor from Yahweh. The one who forfeits me hurts themselves. Those who hate me love death.
That's such a mic drop.
It is. It totally is.
Those who hate me love death.
Yeah. High stakes right there.
Man, what a chapter. I mean, you feel like you've been in a room with the smartest poets and intellectuals in the world when you hang out in Proverbs 8. At least that's how I feel. Then there's so much depth here. It's going to take me the rest of my life to plumb the depths. But what a majestic depiction of something that really is actually fairly intuitive to all humans. There's like probably a way of probably like the more right way of being human. There's probably a way that's more wrong. One way is probably more in tune with how this whole thing is supposed to go, and one way's out of tune. And how do I make the right choices and be the right kind of person? That's really what this is about.
Yeah, it seems like what we gain from this chapter is the understanding that wisdom's ways are in line with the way of the universe, of all creation.
Yeah.
So living according to wisdom is like living according to the grain of God's whole creation. So there's balance and there's peace and there's rightness. And then it's ultimately the most desirable choice. So there's a warning against like the temporary pleasure. And she's saying, I bring abundant goodness and true life. Seems like that's what we gain from this depiction of wisdom.
Well said. I think you just dropped the mic right there.
And also, all those who hate her love death.
All right.
Awesome.
Thanks, friends.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to talk.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Bible Project Podcast. If you liked this episode, you would probably enjoy the video that we just made on Proverbs 8. We're really proud of this video. You can find it at BibleProject.com and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheBibleProject. Today's episode was produced by Zach McKinley and Dan Gummel, Lindsay Ponder, with our show notes and the theme music from the band Tense. Bible Project is a crowdfunded organization that makes free resources for people all over the world to experience the Bible as a unified story that leads to Jesus. And it's possible because of people just like you who've joined in with us along this journey. Thank you so much for being a part of this with us.
Hi, this is Jocelyn and I am from Malaysia. I first heard about Bible Project from a Christian actor on his Instagram story. I use Bible Project for the purpose of how to apply the words of God in my everyday life and live it out. My favorite thing about Bible Project is how you guys take the event that happened in the Old and New Testament, make them into a short animated video so that people could have better understanding of the entire story. We believe the Bible is a unified story that leads to Jesus. We are a crowdfunded project by people like me. Find free videos, study notes, podcasts, classes, and more at BibleProject.com.